Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. A great champion for our country in that war is our first guest. I'm very pleased to welcome back the Honorable, and I mean that in every sense of the word, John Bolton. He formerly served our country in numerous capacities, including as our permanent representative to the United Nations. He is currently a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a regular contributor to Fox News, among other outlets. His book, Surrender is Not an Option, is required reading. I really wish it were being read widely in the Obama administration at the moment, John Bolton, but it does not seem to be the case. Welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Well, thanks for having me, and it's always fun to watch the Obama administration. If our national security weren't at stake, it would be really humorous.
Yeah, no, it's downright comedic, except for that fact that it's so deadly serious. Let's start with one of the places where that deadly serious character is being played out, John, and that is Iraq. We've disengaged. We were led to believe by the president in what I consider to be a case of national security fraud that all would be well. There would be stability, and things would just be swimmingly proceeding without us. Doesn't seem to be the case. You've indicated in a recent analysis that Iran is really the problem here, and we better keep our eye on the ball. Give us a sense of where you think we are and where we need to go.
Well, I think the administration, as usual, is really not clear what it wants to do and is floundering around. I think the meeting with congressional leadership yesterday was the opening round of the finger pointing that I expect we'll see soon from the administration, blaming whatever they are unable to do on a divided Congress. But I think perhaps the most interesting development is reported in the Wall Street Journal this morning, that the administration thinks that the al-Maliki regime in Iraq has to be replaced, that it cannot bring the country back together, and that before any substantial American involvement takes place, that the Iraqis have to replace Maliki with somebody else. And I just want to note this historic moment, that after more than a decade of criticizing President Bush and many others for their terrible, evil policies of regime change, that Barack Obama appears on the verge of calling for regime change in Iraq. You know, this is irony of ironies. But the fact is, the dominant player in the al-Maliki regime is Iran. And given its support for international terrorism financially in terms of weapons and other things, and the ongoing Iranian nuclear weapons program, I wouldn't do anything to strengthen Iran's hand. I think this is a case where ISIS, the jihadists who have taken much of the Sunni territory in Iraq, and the al-Maliki regime are a perfect match for one another, and it, to me, recalls what Henry Kissinger famously said about the Iran-Iraq war: perhaps both sides can lose.
Mr. Besser, you also served as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, and as a result, you're familiar with a product of the State Department. I believe they're called country reports, the most recent edition of which made clear that the Iranians were actually playing both sides of this game in Iraq. They were not only propping up, as you say, the Maliki regime, and apparently they've substantially penetrated it with their own personnel, but they've also evidently been providing support, and this is not exactly a news flash, but it is worth noting in the present context, to al-Qaeda elements. The point being, evidently, that they seek to destabilize the place. And one of the issues that we keep hearing about is the administration is thinking about helping Iranian ground forces, or personnel at least playing the boots on the ground role, by using air power to support them. What do you make of that idea, and what should we be saying and doing about it?
Well, it's a terrible idea, and I think anybody who cares about American national security should be doing everything that we can to stop it. I think the president's The idea that has grabbed him here is that somehow cooperating with Iran in defending al-Maliki in Iraq will build mutual confidence that will help us in the negotiation over Iran's nuclear weapons program. I mean, the president operates under the delusion that Iran can be talked out of its nuclear weapons program. That's false. And any idea that cooperation that actually enhances Iran's power in Iraq will help us on the nuclear side is even more delusional. But, you know, welcome to the Obama White House.
Yeah. You know, I just wonder whether this could possibly be the explanation for what they're doing. The other, which seems to me much more plausible, is that the president has decided Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon and we're just going to have to accommodate ourselves to that. And we better see what we can do to try to fashion better relations with the Iranian regime through things like providing an air force for the Iranians' efforts to establish themselves even more in Iraq. This seems to me, on the face of it, John Bolton, to be a singularly, strategically disastrous attitude towards a country that's, you know, the regime at least, is very clearly hostile to us and determined to destroy us, I think.
Yeah, well, the president's, you know, obviously not saying what's on his mind, but objectively speaking, when you undertake this kind of activity, such as he's talking about, using airstrikes, watching Iranian Revolutionary Guards advisors already on the ground in Iraq, as they are on the ground aiding a puppet on the other side of this conflict, the Assad regime in Syria, you have to wonder if there's not some larger ideological objective at work. This can't be entirely incompetence. At least it defies our experience to think that after even 5.5 years, they can still be so naive.
Yeah, I don't think it's incompetence at all. And one thing we'll be talking about for a while, I'm sure, is the role Valerie Jarrett is playing in all of this, senior White House person with long ties to Iran. I'm very much interested in exploring that further. But John, one other thing, I guess, that I would just ask you, does it make sense in light of what we've now seen is the upshot of a circumstance in which we completely withdraw American forces to repeat the error in Afghanistan, which the president is evidently intent on doing?
Yeah, I think he's exactly on track to get out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. He has used the same pretext, the absence of a status of forces agreement that he used as a fig leaf to get out of Iraq. And I think that the outcome in Afghanistan, if anything, may be even swifter, the Taliban and al-Qaeda take back over. You know, I don't know that maintaining American forces in Iraq would have prevented what we're seeing today, but I'll absolutely guarantee that when Obama withdrew American forces, it was simply a matter of time until we got to the day that we're at now. And as I say, in Afghanistan, I think our withdrawal will bring us to this point with a Taliban al-Qaeda government back in power even sooner.
And what this does to the global jihad is almost incalculable, I'm afraid, and we'll be living with the consequences for some time, if we're lucky. If we're not, we will be dying as a result of the consequences. John, let me just ask you one other question about Iraq, if I may. One of the things that, and again, our guest is Ambassador John Bolton, formerly the U.S. Representative to the United Nations, now with the American Enterprise Institute. Is there one upshot of this, perhaps a new map of the Middle East? We've obviously seen the ISIS group saying, you know, we're now establishing the caliphate between Syria and Iraq. But what about a Kurdistan? Might that come out of this with the old Sykes-Picot lines over the side and perhaps territory from several countries, Iran, Turkey, Syria, becoming part of what's now effectively a rump state in Iraq?
Yeah, no, I think it's entirely possible the thing comes apart. Whether it does so and then restabilizes or whether the entire Middle East sinks into chaos is part of the question. But, you know, the debate over whether we want one Iraq or three Iraqs, I think, is already overtaken. There are two Iraqs by definition. The Kurds have been functionally de facto independent for 20-plus years now. I don't see any way that they would be voluntarily re-entering an integral state of Iraq. I think they're out of it. I think the Turks understand that. And I don't think either the Sunnis or the Shia Arabs in Iraq have any stomach for trying to bring the Kurds back in. honestly, I think that's one reason why the Sunni tribal leaders, the Ba'ath Party remnants in Sunni Iraq have joined up with ISIS, because with the 20% of the population represented by the Kurds gone, the Sunni Arabs would be outnumbered in a new Iraq 3-1 by the Shia. It wouldn't be 60-40 Shia-Sunni. It would be 3-1 against the Sunni. So if they don't get out of Iraq, they're doomed to al-Maliki at best, as far as the eye can see.
And maybe considerably worse than that. John Bolton, we have to let you go. Thank you so much for your past service to our country and that you're continuing to render, not least with the Bolton PAC and Super PAC. I'm very excited about that work. And thanks, too, for your guidance in surrender is not an option. Keep it up. We'll come back to you again very soon. Next up, we talk with Bill Gertz about a space arms control treaty. Will the administration stave it off? Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, I'm Gary Sinise. It's been 20 years since Forrest Gump, and the story of Lieutenant Dan's triumphant return to normalcy is still a part of my life. I'm honored to share it with the real-life Lieutenant Dan's living among us, the more than 1,700 battle-injured amputees that have returned home since 9/11. As citizens, it's our duty to ensure these heroes get the care they need. Join the Gary Sinise Foundation and help support America's wounded heroes. Visit GarySiniseFoundation.org.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation,
then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by our friend Bill Gertz. He is the reporter extraordinaire in the national security space at the Washington Times, where he writes its prize-winning Inside the Ring column. He is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. Bill, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
You have an important piece in the Washington Free Beacon today, Bill, about the apparent rejection by the Obama administration of a treaty on space weaponry that has been advanced by two of the nations that seem most intent on having space weaponry. Tell us what this is all about.
Yes. On June 10th, just a couple of weeks ago, both the governments of Russia and China offered a new draft treaty on the banning of space weapons at the UN Conference on Disarmament in Geneva. This is an example of what is known as lawfare or legal warfare. It's an effort to try to constrain the United States, which is the premier space power. At the same time, they're both secretly developing space arms. In the case of China, they have a fairly significant anti-satellite weapon program that involves missiles and lasers and electronic jammers and small satellites. The Russians also are supposedly secretly developing space weaponry as well. And fortunately, the undersecretary or the principal deputy secretary for verification at the conference said, no way, we're not going to do this. It's not verifiable. However, we're not out of the woods on that because the administration is pushing a European Union concept of a less formal code of conduct in space. And that treaty basically has been, or that issue has been opposed by the Joint Staff, which said it would limit our military space capabilities, such as sensors and satellites and things like that.
Even when the administration gets it right, as you say, Bill, with respect to the Russian-Chinese gambit, they may get it wrong in a way that will be every bit as injurious, perhaps, if they go down this code of conduct route. Bill Gertz is our guest. We're talking with him about some of the hijinks in the space of the war for the free world, known as lawfare, that the Obama administration may get wrong, even though at the moment it seems to be getting at least a part of it right. And Bill, just so we're clear, talk a little bit about the practice. You're a serious student of this business. The Russians and the Chinese understand that by getting us caught up in sort of international treaty arrangements and agreements, that they can have a degree of latitude for their own capabilities that you wouldn't think possible, but very severely restrict ours. Is that how this works, this lawfare, as you call it?
Absolutely. And in the case of the Obama administration, both countries have fairly assessed the Obama administration's urgent priority for doing arms control agreements. And, you know, the United States has always done arms control agreements, going into them with a sincere idea of, you know, protecting national security. That's not the case when it comes to both Russia and China. They view arms control as a means to an end. In other words, they're not going to abide by those treaties. In the case of Russia, virtually every arms agreement they've signed, they violated. And even the pro-arms control community will just try to dismiss them as not militarily significant. The fact is they're cheating. And it's the same with the Chinese. The U.S. has been pushing China to enter into some arms agreements, and the Chinese haven't done it. Now they want to do it as a way to constrain the United States.
Yeah. It's hard to overstate the degree of cynicism and asymmetric warfare that this represents. And we appreciate tremendously, Bill, your exposing it, because I hope that that will help dissuade the Obama administration from going down this road, even in the lesser form of a code of conduct, as they call it. Bill, let me switch gears on you. One of the things that we've been tracking, of course, is the state of the, well, U.S.-Egyptian relationship, I guess we could call it. How is it that we are now seeing the Obama administration finally relenting and deciding that it is in America's interest, after all, to provide attack helicopters to the government of Egypt, the new government under President al-Sisi, only to find that it's being held up in Congress. What's up with that, and what are the implications?
It's a very serious problem. Senator Patrick Leahy, arch-liberal, has blocked the delivery of six Apache helicopters that the Egyptian government urgently requested of the United States back in April. And after a back and forth with the administration, basically the administration reversed course and said, okay, we're going to send these because we understand there's an al-Qaeda threat in the Sinai Peninsula that they need to be addressed. Leahy is claiming that on human rights grounds, the Egyptians haven't made enough progress towards democracy and therefore is holding these up. In other words, he's basically supporting the Muslim Brotherhood regime in an indirect fashion.
Yeah, the former regime, but still very much a threat in Egypt and threat to us, by the way. Bill, again, let me switch gears. You cover so well and so widely the national security portfolio. I wanted to ask you about something you wrote about in your Inside the Ring column in the Washington Times this week, namely an appeal by a senior Air Force officer for the modernization of our bomber leg of the nuclear triad. This is something that apparently we're starting to hear people in the Obama administration think is expendable. As best I can tell, they think so are the land-based and maybe even the sea-based legs of the deterrent. But talk a little bit about the necessity, as we now have had it explained, of taking steps to replace some of the incredibly ancient bomber aircraft that we're asking our young men and women to operate and the nature of our nuclear deterrent.
Yes. Earlier this week, Air Force General Garrett Harensack, he's a major general. He's also in charge of strategic nuclear forces for the Air Force staff. He gave a speech to a group of industry officials and basically made an impassioned appeal for a new bomber. And he just laid out in stark detail how old our aircraft are. And one of the examples, he said, his son is currently an Air Force captain pilot at Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, and his son is flying the same B-52 bomber, strategic bomber, that he flew when he was a young officer in the Air Force. And he made the point that his grandson could be flying the same plane because the Air Force is planning to continue flying the B-52s till the year 2040. And so he made this appeal. He said all legs of the strategic triad are in need of modernization. The Minuteman III is a 1970s weapon. All of our Ohio-class submarines are nearing the end of their life or will be. And so right now the Air Force is pushing for a long-range strike bomber that's one of their top priorities. And it's still kind of wrapped in secrecy, but they're talking about doing both a manned and unmanned version. And it will be the premier aircraft. They want 100 aircraft, and they want it to come online by 2020. Obviously, with the big budget fights going on now, there's questions about whether they're going to try and keep the old air fleet going or build this new bomber. And, of course, General Harensack was saying, look, we really urgently need this new bomber.
Yeah, 2020 sounds very ambitious. I can't think of a major acquisition program, and this certainly would be a major acquisition program that has come to fruition in anything remotely like that period of time. But I certainly very much strongly concur with the general's warnings about the obsolescence of the aircraft, not to say just the age, but I'm afraid the ability to do their job is increasingly in question as well. Bill, we have to leave it at that, I think, for the moment. Thank you very much, as always, for the superb job you do covering these issues at the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times. Your many important books on the subject, including Failure Factory most recently, are deeply appreciated as well. We look forward to visiting with you again next week. Come back to us soon. We'll talk with Bill Roggio now. We'll get his take on the long war at the moment, including the developments in Libya, right after this.
Hugh Hewitt.
keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Barack Obama perpetrated national security fraud when he assured us that the hasty and complete removal of U.S. forces from Iraq would end the war there. Even then, it was obvious that the American military's presence gave Iraqis a chance to overcome sectarian and ethnic differences. Its termination by Obama cleared the way for purges and bloodletting with worse sure to come. That's especially so given that Obama's own State Department has reported that Iran has been working to destabilize its neighbor. Presumably, the mullahs want a pretext for establishing formal hegemony over at least Iraq's oil-rich south. Now, with Sunni jihadists on the march in Iraq, President Obama is reportedly considering providing air cover for ground operations there by Iran's Shiite jihadists. That's a formula for an even greater disaster. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement? And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Roggio. He is the managing editor of the Long War Journal, a marvelous online resource brought to us by the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. You can find it at longwarjournal.org. I regard it as required reading every day. I hope everyone else listening will do the same. Bill is also a senior fellow with the Foundation and a Hoover Institute media fellow and a jolly good fellow to join us each week as he does. Bill, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Always a pleasure.
Let's start with the capture of Ahmed Abu Qatala in Libya. Tell us, first of all, who this cat is again, and why it is that we got him now rather than a long time before.
Yeah, Qatala is one of the key planners and operatives who were involved in the attack on the U.S. diplomatic facilities in Benghazi. And this is a guy that's appeared in the media multiple times. He works with Ansar al-Sharia in Libya. Just an absolute nasty guy. And he's, like I said, he has been operating openly in the region. And there's even reports in the media that the U.S. intelligence has been tracking him for well over a year.
Well, according to Hillary Clinton, she said the other day that they had been looking for him basically from the night of the attack. Do you credit that, especially given what she has said for quite some time, was her conviction that this was all about a video? There was no jihadist attack at all.
I mean, his capture, the administration will tout it as, look, we're pursuing Benghazi. That's great. We should go after the guys, and they should be commended for taking him in. But every time something like this happens, their story just crumbles a little further. If we were tracking him since day one, then we were aware that this wasn't an attack related to, some movie defaming the Prophet Muhammad, but it was actually plotted by al-Qaeda-linked individuals. So, again, it's every time they open their mouth on this, they really stick their foot in it, and it's, I think we know the real story, but the administration has been less than truthful in disclosing what really happened in Benghazi.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I guess a question that just occurs as well is, have they been less than prompt as they could have been in rolling this guy up, given that they've been looking for him this long? And as you say, they've had him under surveillance for a long time. One wonders whether there might be some connection between the fact that there is now a select committee getting up and running and their decision to apprehend this fellow. Let me turn to another subject, if I may, Bill Roggio of the Lone War Journal with you. You are, of course, following closely, as is your colleague Tom Jocelyn and the rest of your team, the developments in Iraq, notably the rising tide of this group ISIS out of Syria. Bill, what's your current reading on how this is shaping up, the evident siege of one of the key oil refineries in Beji in Iraq, and where things are likely to go from here?
Yeah, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham now controls about a third to a quarter to a third of Iraq geographically. They've pressed from Mosul to the outskirts of a city called Samarra. That's the one that hosts that the shrine and the mosque that was blown up in 2006 that sparked the Sunni Shia sectarian fighting. So they advanced hundreds of miles over the course of days. And it looks like ISIS is seeking to squeeze off Samarra and areas north of Baghdad so they could surround the city and then just pretty much start its terror campaign, just like it did in 2006. We actually found a map from on Zarqawi that detailed this plan. And when I'm looking at how ISIS is operating, how they're moving, the areas they're moving into, I think they basically dusted off this old battle plan. And keep in mind, it took 130,000 U.S. troops partnered with Awakening Forces. Those are the Sunni tribal militias that were enabled by the U.S., along with our air power and special operations raids, as well as Iraqi security forces that were partnered with U.S. units. It took more than a year to clean out Baghdad, the areas around it, and eject al-Qaeda in Iraq from the provinces. ISIS has been in control of these areas north of Baghdad for a week, and in Anbar province for almost 6 months now. I don't see how we think that the weakened Iraqi government that saw two divisions dissolve in the face of ISIS assault, I don't see how we can expect them to retake all of these areas. They might be able to take some, but they're not going to take them all.
Yeah. One of the things that I was talking about earlier in the program with John Bolton, Bill Roggio, was the evident consideration being given by the Obama administration of having the role previously played by U.S. forces, which you just described, be played now by Iranian elements, perhaps backed up by American air power. What do you make of that idea?
Well, first of all, if you want civil war in Iraq, you want a real civil war, you want zero cooperation from Sunnis, go ahead and allow Iranians to act as the infantry for the Maliki government. And by the way, there's going to be a bunch of Shia that are not going to be happy about this as well. It's always assumed that because they're Iraqi Shia that they're sympathetic to the Iranians. It's just not the case. There's actually very big differences between the two groups.
Arab versus Persian, among other things, yeah, and a lot of bad blood over the years with their wars. Bill, let me just ask you, on the point that you've sort of touched on several times, because I think it's hard for people to get their head around it, the number of personnel that are armed and equipped and running under the ISIS banner, which stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham, is relatively small. If we think that they are actually holding a third of Iraq, it must be with the assent, if not the very active support, of large numbers of the people who formerly made up the Awakening and the tribes that helped liberate the place from al-Qaeda in the past. Is that your reading of it? Have they now brought around basically all of the Sunnis, or effectively the majority?
Either they're coward, which, by the way, we saw this in Iraq. A lot of the – when the al-Qaeda in Iraq controlled large areas of Iraq back in 2005, 6, and 7 – it wasn't because they were extremely popular. It was because they were extremely effective, and they were adept at targeting tribal leaders, splitting tribal alliances, and keeping people on the sideline or forcing them to join their ranks. And also, the other thing they're doing is they are working with allied groups. The irony of this is ISIS, is Islamic State of Iraq and Sham, or ISIS, inside Syria, they've been very opposed to working with other jihadist groups and whatnot. But in Iraq, they're actually partnering with former Ba'athists and other jihadist groups. So they have a smart strategy. The tribes that they're able to get on their side, it's effective. And the ones they're able to sideline they're doing so because they're just frightened. They've seen this movie before. It was pre-2007.
Bill, let me just throw out a quick question, and we won't have time to discuss it, but I'm be interested in your reaction. One of the things that the ISIS guys have very explicitly said they're about is rewriting the map of the Middle East. They're going to create a caliphate that crosses the border between Syria and Iraq. Another place where the map might be quite usefully redrawn, it seems to me, is by creating a so-called Kurdistan. Involving not just the Kurdish areas of Iraq, but perhaps parts of Iran and Syria and Turkey as well, all of which are problematic for our purposes. Might this actually create a new dynamic that would be a counterweight, as well as, you know, recognizing the legitimate claims of a Kurdish people long denied a territory of their own?
The danger in that, in theory, it sounds great. The danger in that is that it could lead to the crushing of the Kurds from several different directions. Especially the Turks and the Iranians would absolutely go ballistic over this. And, you know, this is one of their fears. This is why. So, you know, we think that, wow, that'd be great. But the Turks aren't going to acquiesce to that, to losing territory. The Iranians, the Syrians, and the Iraqis, they're all going to have serious issues. So it could actually mean not necessarily the extermination of the Kurdish people, but the extermination of Kurdish independence. And that could actually backfire on it.
Bill, we'll have to leave it at that for the moment. We'll be talking about all of this, I know, for weeks to come, if not longer. Thanks so much for the work you do at the Long War Journal and for joining us each week as you do. Next up, we'll be talking with Andy McCarthy. We'll get his take on this Katala exercise. And are we going to Mirandize this guy? And we'll get the intelligence he has out of him first. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the inspector general handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the high point of our week, the visit with Andy McCarthy, just back from a wonderful tour of the Left Coast in connection with his new book, Faithless Execution, Making the Political Case for Obama's Impeachment. Andy McCarthy is, of course, a columnist and pundit extraordinaire these days, a former federal prosecutor and a regular feature of this program. for which I'm very grateful. Welcome back, Andy. It's good to have you with us.
Frank, nice to be with you.
I was talking in the previous segment a little bit with Bill Roggio about this fellow Ahmed Abed Abu Qatala. You've observed that there are several pieces of this story that warrant our attention. Maybe we could start with the idea that it took this long to snag him. Hillary Clinton says she's been looking for him since night one. What's up with all that?
If they were looking for him for night one, and Hillary was as well, I guess he must be a devotee of anti-Muslim videos, I imagine, since that was the con job she was running from that night on. So it was
he claims he was, as a matter of fact. That would be part of his defense.
Yeah, he's probably got a good Gitmo lawyer. You know, I know there are less of those guys now that they found a lot of job openings in the Obama administration, but I'm sure there's still a number of good ones out there. So,
well, and they're also working the problem from inside the Justice Department, needless to say.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, look, I think this has all the makings of exactly what we never wanted with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, what the American people made clear they didn't want, which was a three-ring circus at a civilian trial at a theater near you. I think part of this is really the campaign to return us to a pre-9/11 counterterrorism paradigm. And as usual with the Obama administration, as time goes on and as that makes less and less sense, they seem more and more hell-bent on doing it. But it's clear, at least to me, that what they are trying to do here and what they are doing here is moving away from the law of war paradigm, which enables you to detain people indefinitely, interrogate them without counsel. I'm not talking about enhanced interrogation measures, but I'm talking about an interrogation that is not interfered with or aborted by having counsel and having the strictures of the criminal due process, the civilian criminal due process system imposed on it. And frankly, Frank, I don't get why they are so, other than for ideological reasons, I don't get why they are so in a rush to do this. We can have this argument about whether the guy belongs in a civilian trial or a military trial, but there's no reason anyone has to make that decision now. There's a 5-year statute of limitations on federal crimes. If they're charged as conspiracies and the conspiracies are ongoing, that means the statute of limitations hasn't even begun to run yet, which means there's no reason that you have to indict and start a trial against this guy anytime soon. Even if you want him in the civilian system, there's no reason he can't be designated an enemy combatant and held indefinitely and interrogated for as long as he's useful as an intelligence source. And they are short-circuiting that in the middle of a war in connection with people who have been very efficient at killing Americans and lately killing everybody else, just so that they can get him in the civilian criminal justice system. It makes no sense either as a criminal justice matter, or certainly as a national security matter.
I guess that's the point, Andy. It's not just that it doesn't make any sense. It's that it can be absolutely counterproductive in terms of not only national security, as you say, but public safety. The conspiracy is certainly ongoing. As you pointed out, there's a fellow by the name of Soufiane Ben Koumou, who is believed to have also been involved in the attack on our facilities in Benghazi, an alumnus of the Gitmo detainee program, who is back in the fight. And so you're absolutely right. This conspiracy is still ongoing.
It's part of the Al-Qaeda conspiracy, which is ongoing.
Also ongoing as well, and Al-Qaeda and global jihad and so on. But Andy, specifically, one of the things that you've pointed out is not only if they Mirandize this guy in the near future, do you see the end of those useful interrogations as a practical matter, but he may also begin to tap into our intelligence capabilities. And this is just obscene.
This is exactly right, Frank. The common sense thing to do would be treat him as an enemy combatant and as an intelligence source. And with respect to that, you can't, contrary to what the administration has said when these situations have come up in the past, you can't take a few hours or a few days to take somebody who is obviously a goldmine of potential intelligence and wring all of it that you need to get from him in terms of what our national security is. And in wartime, in particular, when the enemy is still conducting offensive operations against us, And when this guy is called a ringleader, precisely because he has a ring that he's involved in, that we haven't obviously identified or detained any of the members other than him, it's just astonishing that you would not only short-circuit his interrogation, which should go on for months or even a couple of years if that's what it takes, but if you start the criminal justice process, that means he's going to be in discovery. So instead of us finding out his information, we're going to be giving him our intelligence files on Al-Qaeda so he can prepare for a trial that there's absolutely no reason to be in a rush to have.
Yeah, absolutely not. And it's not just obscene. I really think it's malfeasance and may rank up there with the other list of high crimes and misdemeanors that you've been compiling in connection with your book, Faithless Execution. Andy, let me turn quickly to two other topics. One, you launched this week an incredibly important new initiative. I'm proud to be playing a small part in it, the Benghazi Accountability Coalition. Talk a little bit about the rollout at the Heritage Foundation and the peculiar treatment thereof by the Washington Post's Dana Milbank.
We really tried to first unfold the scope of the Benghazi scandal to kind of narrow the focus then on what President Obama knew when he knew it and what he did about it on the night of September 11, 2012. When four Americans, including our ambassador, were killed in an act of war by jihadist terrorists. And finally, to anticipate the challenges that lay ahead of the select committee under Chairman Trey Gowdy, which will be looking at this. So that was what we try to do in our event. I think we did it very successfully. Dana Milbank, as I understand it, he had a quite the rant on Monday. I have seen snippets of it. It is hard for me to read something from beginning to end that he writes because it's just astonishing sometimes, particularly since he's covering something that he and I were both at, and it seems like we witnessed a different event.
No, but I think the point of even bringing it up really was to say that one of the criticisms that was mounted by several of us, including notably the chairman of the panel on which I served, Chris Plant, a wonderful talk show host here in Washington, was that partly why this coalition is so needed is the press is not doing its job. And lo and behold, Dana Milbank gave us an object lesson in,
right,
in how they're not
and
why they're not. Yeah, it really was a parody.
Yeah, he's worried about how a Muslim student was received who, as I understand afterwards, the person we're talking about was identified and you know, she has a well-deserved reputation as something of an agitator and obviously tried to take the conference in a different direction. He misrepresented the reaction to her. You know, she started her remarks out by saying something along the lines of, you know, I know we all hate Muslims, and not only is that not true, it was like very far removed from what the conference was about. So she was just, it was an exercise in soft demagoguery. And I would point out that both you and other people were quite adamant that, you know, number one, nobody is drawing conclusions about the entire Muslim community on the basis of the terrorists. So it's not true that we hate all Muslims, as however it was that that she put it. And secondly, that we all long for the day when moderate Muslims are going to step up to the plate as a meaningful force in our public dialogue and condemn the kind of activities that we've seen in Benghazi and elsewhere. We're all anxious to have that day come.
Andy, we have to let it go at that, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for joining me. As always, we'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.